You're listening to Girovagando by the Cycling Podcast. Today we are in Andorra.
Kocce šitele, kocce, kocce vištine, nuspi gude šikora, nuspi gude šikora. Kocce šitele, kocce, kocce vištine, nuspi gude šikora, se nu manciano le femmine.
Chin chin. Brian,
Chin Chin,
which we discovered last night, has nothing to do with Cinzano. We were driving to our hotel in Guarene, and what a beautiful hotel it was in Piedmont, in sort of, well, Piedmontese wine country near Alba. And we went through Cinzano, which has also been on the route of the stage yesterday. And this led me to speculate whether the Italian custom of saying Chin Chin when you charge your glasses and you, well, you clink glasses, whether that had anything to do with Cinzano. And you looked it up.
Much to my surprise, it didn't.
It didn't. And I'd looked this up before, but I'd completely forgotten.
Yeah. It's actually...
It was Chinese, wasn't it? It was Mandarin.
Yeah, it's taken from however that's pronounced. But I can hear the Chinese sort of, it resonates in the words, doesn't it? Like linguistically.
Yeah, we don't know how the Italians, why the Italians adopted this and why other countries have not adopted it. Do you say in English, chin chin? I don't think so.
No.
Maybe you do in other countries of the world. Anyway, Brian, could you tell, I know where we are. Tell the listeners where we are, please.
Well, then we are in Andorra, not the Andorra we usually connect to cycling, in the little enclave in the Pyrenees.
Fiscal jokes.
Yeah. We are in Andorra on the Ligurian coast. And it's been at least two seasons in a day. You know, we went from... quite rainy, dreary weather up in Piedmont, and more or less as soon as we hit the coast, the sun came out, and it was, you know, with the Ligurian Sea blinkering in our eyes.
That's exactly what a journey like the one we undertook today around about lunchtime should look like and feel like, isn't it? It's you know, in cycling we have the race to the sun, Paris-Nice, and when you do that race, you always feel that when you get below Lyon, then you start to see the sun. That usually is the case. Similarly, when you leave Piemonte and you go over the mountains, and in Milan San Remo's case, it's often the Turchino, that's often where you start to see the sun. And that was pretty much how it worked out for us today, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a rite of passage in cycling, going from one... I mean, Milan San Remo's nickname is also La Primavera. And, I mean, we're almost in close to summer. Mm. It certainly feels like that sitting here in the evening sun.
Brian, you're sitting here with a spritz. We're not in spritz country yet, but I'm sitting here with a Ribolla Gialla, a local white wine.
It's a local... Is Ribolla Gialla? It's from Friuli, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, that's wrong. Got that badly wrong, didn't I? Well, obviously, it's not wine I've drunk very often, Ribolla Gialla. I didn't know it was from Friuli. I was going to go for a Pigato. I should have gone for a local one. Brian, something I found out about Andorra this afternoon. Its most famous son, well, he's not the cyclist Mirko Celestino, who is from here and who won the Tour of Lombardy. I also rode this last 60 kilometres of Milan-San Remo with him once, and his apartment was just a few metres from where we're sitting.
I think I read that. I mean, this is like a long time ago.
About 2005, 2006. He's not the most famous sort of son of Andorra, because there was another very adopted famous son, a Norwegian who I'd never heard of called Tor Heyerdahl. I think some of the listeners will have heard of him. He settled here, and he was very famous for the Kon-Tiki expedition.
Oh, every Danish child knows that story.
Yeah, he was
his exploits on the raft.
Yeah, he was a Norwegian adventurer, ethnographer, and in 1947 he sailed 8,000 kilometers across the Pacific Ocean in a hand-built raft from South America.
He was trying to prove that it was possible.
Yeah.
Because historians said that there was, you know, when the discovery of continents, etc. And he did it to prove a point.
And he died here, Brian, in 2002, having, according to the internet, completely restructured, rebuilt the abandoned... Well, they call it a borgo here, it was like a sort of hamlet or a kind of fortified hamlet which had fallen into disrepair, of Colla Micheri, which is just, Brian, where I'm pointing, a few kilometers over there. So Tor Heyerdahl.
Who would have thought there would be that much money in sailing around a raft on the big seas of the
Do you think he was a rich man when he died? Probably
I don't
not.
Know, but he rebuilt that hamlet, didn't he?
Maybe our good friend Magnus Ora, the Norwegian journalist who's not at the Giro d'Italia, will be able to give us more information about Mr. Heyerdahl. Brian, we saw an exciting sprint finish. It was a Milan San Remo style stage, and it was a Milan tribute of a denouement of an outcome. I think I've probably given too much away already, but I think with that, let's proceed immediately to today's Processo alla Tappa.
Il Processo alla Tappa, the post-stage inquisition.
Brian, it falls to me to pose the questions in this Processo alla Tappa as tradition dictates. And where did we start this morning? And, well, we've come to Andorra. How many kilometres did the peloton ride today?
The stage from Aquiterme to Andorra. What a nice place Aquiterme was, by the way. It was part of wine country there.
There was
I didn't know, though,
wasn't there?
Yeah,
there was some light rain this morning, but it cleared up.
So 190 kilometres so far, the longest stage of this Giro. Last year, it wouldn't even have made the top five.
No, that's true. And Brian, it will be unforgivable if you get this wrong, because we saw this. Well, we saw breakaways form because we were at the side of the road. We were trying to negotiate our way to the finish, and we got held up. And we were alongside the route of the Giro, and we saw this was kilometer one, two. We saw various breaks trying to form. Tell me about the breaks today, please.
Yeah, so it was quite early where we was. We literally shortly after kilometer zero where we were standing trying to get out of there, I suppose. And it was a very early breakaway consisting of four riders. And one of them was actually Filippo Ganna, but he set up he only participated in 15 kilometers or so, that breakaway. But the others kept going. And it was Stefan de Bort, Lilian Calmejan, and Francesco Munoz. Eventually, once Lilian Calmejan had gotten the points on the Colle del Melogno, so that category three climb in the middle of the stage, he set up and let the two others go. But then all kinds of things happened. I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself here.
No, proceed.
Okay, thank you. Well, there's quite a few crashes today. Some early, and some, most of them actually happened on the descent of the Colle del Melogno. I also feel like I need to say that quite a few riders had a tough time on that climb, one of them being Fabio Jakobsen getting dropped quite early, Gaviria as well. But there was a pretty serious crash with, I have to say, before that it was just 85 to go, Ethan Vernon and Jonathan Narváez crashed. They both made it back up again. But with 69 kilometers to go, six riders crashed, including Ben O'Connor, Matteo Trentin, and sadly, Binyan Girmay as well. And sadly, because he actually got up again, but then once he got up on the bike, he crashed one more time 5 kilometers later, and then he actually exited the race. The two riders in front, they kept going, and with 57 kilometers to go, they actually had 2.5 minutes. At 19 kilometers to go, they were down to 1 minute. And then they finally got caught at the foot of the Capo Mela, just past the town of La Guelia, another famous cycling town. I believe we spoke about that yesterday. Can I take this all the way to the finish, please?
You can, Brian.
Okay, so
be my guest.
On the Capo Mela, there was a fiammata, a flaming attack by none other than Filippo Ganna, top Ganna.
Yeah, I was waiting for a pun to fall into my lap about, so mele in Italian means apples, and a Pogacar attack and a Pogacar sort of flourish at the finish line. How do you like them apples? But it didn't happen.
Alas, it wasn't to be. No. Yeah, so Ganna, and it was a pretty serious attack, and he bridged the Capo Mela first. There were guys trying to follow him. Van Poppel tried, got caught. Pasqualon tried, got caught. And there was a Bardiani rider.
Fiorelli.
Yeah, Fiorelli again, who was the last guy to hang on, but he also got dropped. And Ganna bombed down the descent towards Andorra, but around 700 meters into finish, it was all over. And the sprinter's train, or the lead-out men, started to very seriously ramp it up. And it was a real proper, I wouldn't say a bunch sprint, because I think there's a lot of riders who didn't really never came to the fore. Jonathan Milan had a perfect lead out, I believe, by Consonni, not the least. And he took his fourth win of the season. Milan did. You know, remember, he was second yesterday. He's won in Vuelta Valenciana, and he's also won two stages in Tirreno Adriatico. So a very good start indeed for Little Trek in this Giro d'Italia.
Brian, who else was in the top 10, please?
Yeah, so who in the top 10? Jonathan Milan won, Caden Gross was second. He did quite a late surge to the finish line. It almost looked like Tim Merlier would be second, but he sort of ran out of gas. He had a pretty good trajectory, but Caden Gross was definitely getting closer. Say if it had been 50 more meters, it could have been a photo finish. Phil Bauhaus third, Olaf Koy fourth, Tim Merlier fifth. He lost the points jersey today. It's now on the shoulders of Jonathan Milan. Davide Ballerini sixth, Gaviria seventh. So he recovered, obviously, from his troubles on the climb. Enrico Sanoncello, that's a new name for me, eighth. Mattis Mikkels from Antamaché, ninth.
Whose fan club we have seen most days.
Yeah, with Brian. Flags.
Yeah, I keep meaning to speak to them. I don't know whether they're related to him. Whether family members.
This almost rings a bell. Giovanni Lonardi, not Lombardi, from Polti Cometa was 10th.
And a few other notable names a little bit further down. Guys who you might have thought, hoped, if you were one of their fans, would have contended today. Caleb Ewan, 12th place. Not the best day for him. Alberto Dainese. You mentioned Jakobsen, Brian, earlier on. He has struggled at the start of this Giro d'Italia. In fact, I was talking to our friend Hans Hugenberg just a few minutes ago, and I think he'd spoken to Jakobsen, and Jakobsen confirmed that he's found first few days of the Giro d'Italia, particularly all of the climbing, tough going. Brian, do we have any significant changes on the general classification?
I mean, I wouldn't call it significant, but Kian Uttebroeks took a second
in the intermediate sprint.
In Savona, actually, and he has once again switched places with Dana Ubio. So Uttebroeks is 55 seconds, 1 second up on Anil Rubio on fifth at 56. Tadej Pogacar still leads the Giro with 46 seconds to Geraint Thomas and 47 seconds to Dani Martinez.
Brian, who's in the other jerseys tonight?
Like I mentioned earlier, Jonathan Milan took the points jersey from Tim Merlier, and he leads that with 113 to Tim Merlier's 81. The KOM, even if Kamajan did cross the midway climb today as the first rider, he's still second in the climbers' classement. Pogacar leads that with 51 to 32 points. And the young rider's jersey is on the shoulders of Sian Uytterbrooks, who leads it with 45 seconds to Alex Podang of Decathlon Agir d'Auxerre La Mondiale.
Incidentally, Dani Martinez, who was wearing the blue jersey today, he wasn't the leader of the mountains competition, but he was in the blue jersey because he was second in that competition overnight. He had a punctured knee in the but it was in the closing 3 kilometers, so no damage for him on general classification. Brian, well,
that does mean that Kalmajan, sorry, Dani, will be in that jersey tomorrow, yes.
And he deserves it. He's worked very hard for it.
Yeah, definitely. He's invested a lot in that.
Yeah,
for sure.
And some consolation for his team, who, as you said, have lost Biniam Girmay today in that crash. Brian, you mentioned Little Trek's excellent lead out. They were, the best organised lead out train, certainly in the finale. You said it was perfect. It looked pretty perfect.
But I also have to say, if it wasn't for them, I think Ghana would have taken the stage. They really took charge in upping the tempo on the Kapomele, and they were well positioned on the descent as well. And yeah, thanks to them that Ghana did.
They were the only ones who didn't hesitate. And any hesitation at that point would have been absolutely fatal as far as the group's chances of getting Ghana back were concerned. They didn't feel that it was absolutely pitch perfect, but it was close to perfect. And we're going to hear now from Simone Consonni, who was the last man in the leader, and Edward Turns, who I think was the penultimate guy in the train. And after that, Brian, just on a subject that we've discussed over the last couple of days, Ineos Grenadiers, their tactics, their positioning. I have to say, I think in terms of positioning, forget tactics for a minute, but positioning, they've been excellent the first 3 days. Whenever Geraint Thomas has needed to be at the front of the peloton, he has been, and he was today going on to Kapomele. They've got a lot of experience, of course, in that team. Connor Swift, Ben Swift, and so on and so forth. So we're going to hear from Consonni, Turns, and then we're going to hear from Ben Swift about precisely that, Ineos Grenadiers and their positioning in these first stages of the Giro d'Italia.
Actually, we did a great job. We are here to full for the sprints. Johnny's show yesterday. A great shape, and yeah, we are really happy about today's win.
How hard or how important was it not to panic when Filippo got that gap?
For sure I didn't panic because I didn't have the legs to follow, so I just tried to manage until the top of the Capo Mele, and in the end we find all together, and Johnny was amazing. Maybe I let him a little bit, you know, like 300 meter to 50, but he had a great shape, and he make it.
Well, it's a perfect scenario for Jonathan in the end. But what did you talk about this morning? How did you think the last sort of 5 kilometers were going to look this morning?
Yeah, of course the positioning before the Capo was very important, and we had the goal to still have our lead out together on the top there. And I think Jasper, I mean, the whole team that amazing work before the Capo, and then the last bit before, Jasper, me and Johnny were wheel in wheel, and I know Jasper very well, and he knows me very well, and I think we did there a really good positioning without spending too much energy, and then coming together to the front and setting in our move in the downhill to try to catch Ghana. I think everything went quite well. It was maybe a little bit early, but going downhill at the speed, and we had to close the gap also to Ghana, so I dropped them maybe a bit far, but I was hoping Simone could maybe take a bit of advantage of Ghana for his lead out. And in the end, we can always count on Milan, who is amazingly strong. He's a beast, and he showed already yesterday that he was amazingly strong, but maybe there he was a bit too much in the win and too eager to win. But today I think he really focused on our wheel, and we dropped him in a good position on the good way without spending too much energy. So we're super happy, and it takes a bit of pressure away from us now towards the next sprints.
You said you maybe went a little bit early, but what's the key on a sprint like that, basically a downhill sprint? When you come in with that speed, what's the key?
Yeah, it's quite hard because actually the turns in the front are maybe even harder because you go at such a bit speed, and if you hit the wind, it's like hitting a wall almost. So you have to push really hard to keep the speed high to prevent them coming from behind. And but also Ghana was still on a good gap, so I wanted to try to get the lead out going pretty early, so we were sure that we could catch back Ghana. And and then I think Johnny is always super strong. He can do a long sprint also, so I think he really, really deserves it.
You know, it's funny when people kind of criticize what you're doing when we went onto the front on the second day, but it's all about positioning. You know, it's like that you saw how technical that downhill was. It's all about safety and trying to get through the best as possible and using certain riders in different times. So I think we've pulled together really well. I wasn't feeling my best today, but obviously Connor stepped up a hell of a lot there and did a huge amount of work, and I could play a bit of a role in the end there. So I think what we've got here, we've got a team that can really interchange and work really well together. And yeah, I mean, we've got good vibes. Obviously, we're trying every day. You know, we've been on the, apart from yesterday, where did we finish yesterday? I can't remember. But good atmosphere, and I think we're trying to animate the race as well as trying to perform as well, yeah.
Just on that bin at the front and the way you did, set the pace on stage two. I mean, the sort of analogy I always use is, if you're on the front, it's a bit like you taking an Uber or a taxi. You can go wherever you want. Whereas if you're not, it's like taking the bus, and you have to, you know, you have to sort of walk a long way at the end, and it's not necessarily going to take you exactly where you want to go.
No, definitely, you know, and it's all about, you've got to invest to save energy. You know, it's all about safety as well and stuff like that. But yeah, exactly, you know, you've got to be at the front, and it also shows good team commitment as well and sets a bit of a standard.
I was looking the other day, your first Giro d'Italia, 2009. Mm. Long time, isn't it?
Yeah, bloody long time ago now. 16 years, yeah.
But what's the main thing that's changed since then?
Well, I think just the overall speed and just the sheer amount of people that are at a high level. You know, it's just like before when there were, if you pulled 400, 410 watts, you'd be in like a select front group, whereas now there's 100 people. But that's just the professionalism across the sport that's grown and stuff like that, you know?
The cycling podcast at the 2024 Giro d'Italia is supported by MAP, cycling apparel.
Brian, Jonathan Milan tonight is a double Giro d'Italia stage winner. His track buddies were very prominent in the finale there. Consonni, who is one member of the Italian Pursuit Quartet with Milan. And also, of course, Filippo Ganna, who almost thwarted them.
Who did they beat to become Olympic champions?
Well, you're asking me about track cycling. I mean, come on. Denmark. I'm going to say Denmark.
Correct.
When was this?
At the last time we had the Olympic Games. And Denmark was actually leading until Ghana absolutely blew the door off the hinges on the last rounds.
I've just switched off. Brian,
the Olympic medal, Olympic medal.
Olympic medal. I don't know if that intimate knowledge that they each have of each other, and particularly Consonni has of Ghana, helped them today. But it was a really interesting move from Ghana. Interesting as well that he said after the finish that it wasn't something that he particularly planned. If anything, if there was a moment to attack, he thought, and Ineos thought, that it might be towards the top of Capo Mele. However, sort of impulsively, instinctively, at the bottom, he took off. And at one stage, it looked very good for Ganna, didn't it? I mean, I said...
It's kind of like the carbon copy of Milan-San Remo in a lot of ways. You know, you have that very last climb where 2 seconds difference once you crest and head down for like this really fast descent. It really makes the final difference.
Absolutely. And you're banking on the fact that someone is going to hesitate. And as I said earlier, quite a lot of teams did and were hesitating at that point, except Little Trek. And that's a bit of a feature of Little Trek, I must say, particularly when Mads Pedersen is riding. They really commit, and they really commit well. And then Jonathan Milan, well, it was a perfect finale for him in the sense that it was downhill. Maybe more on that in a minute, because there were some riders who suggested it was very dangerous. Tim Merlier said that he was just pleased to get out alive. That's how dangerous he thought it was. But Milan, we all know, we heard there, Edward Turns refer to him as a beast. He is a bit of a beast in terms of the watts that he puts out. Been some criticism, not criticism, some sort of, well, they would say constructive criticism by some golden oldies of sprinting over the last few days. And indeed, I remember this from last year's Giro as well. I mean, he's very tall, isn't he? And consequently, it's difficult for him to look particularly, well, very stylish on the bike, particularly when he is sprinting. But I know Mario Cipollini in his Zampart, in his column for Tutto Bici Web, talked about his choice of gears. And this has been said before about Milan, that he doesn't ride a big enough gear. And one thing I didn't find out after the finish, but I would have been curious to know whether any of the sprinters or many of the sprinters were using a bigger chainring than usual today with that downhill finish in mind.
I think so. I overheard, I think, Davide Cassani on the... who is the technical commentator, I believe they call him here on Italian TV, mentioning that there was even a 57-10 gear ratio for some riders. I mean, if you look at the sprint in slow motion replay, you also see that he kept a very straight line, Jonathan Milan, and he almost got... I wouldn't say pushed, but there was a bit of elbows between him and Olaf Koy. And when you see those two next to each other, it's like, you know, it's almost like David and Goliath. They're unlike physically, you know, in terms of their presence, but both are probably some of the fastest sprinters of today's cycling.
And Brian, Coy got a very good lead out as well from Christophe Laporte. And there was an interesting side-on image where you saw really well that Milan almost double kicked. I don't know whether it was him double kicking or others just fading at that point, but Merlier, who had come at him like a rocket, like the rocket of, what is it, Vortigern?
Yeah.
That's his, living up to his nickname.
It looked like Merlier had the right trajectory, then ran out of gas, and then it actually looked like...
Groves.
Ken Groves had it right, but... And you could almost say that Coy had it, like, on a silver platter. So I think that it's obviously a deserved win nonetheless, but he just, they timed it right, they committed the team, perfect lead out from Consonni, and all in all, it was really a textbook of how well you can organize yourself for a final like today's.
So as I said, Milan's second Giro d'Italia stage when he went in San Salvo last year, and I suppose...
Is that in the deep south?
San Salvo's on the Adriatic coast. I don't know whether it's in I think it's in Abruzzo.
I remember that now, yes.
It was one of the first stages, in fact. Brian, I suppose that this Giro d'Italia and winning here in the company that he is keeping in this Giro, because as we've said, this is a very, very strong sprint field. This will change the way people look at Milan. It might change the way he looks at himself. It might change the way his team considers him as well. I mean, he's really joining the international jet set as far as sprinters are concerned now. There is, as I say, there is still this kind of image of him. I don't know whether it's because of his relative inexperience on the track. He's only 23 years of age, but that he's a bit of a sort of unpolished diamond, that his sprint is a little bit agricultural, a little bit rustic.
Yeah, but haven't you noticed once a sprinter turns from being a fast finisher to a super sprinter, you know, those riders who are in a category of their own, they're almost unknown until they get that first, you remember Cav's first Grand Tour, his first Tour de France stage. I mean, he was extremely young and just a chubby little short kid, wasn't he? I mean, but it just completely changes everything. From being relatively unknown to superstardom in cycling is all it takes is a couple of stage wins. And you also see other stars sort of fading. You know, I think I counted maybe like 14 riders who could potentially win today's stage. But then you have this little kick before the end, and some might make it over. But it's just the strongest guys who can make it over and still have something in the legs for the final push.
Yes, indeed, Brian. Milan, of course, from Tolmezzo up in, you mentioned, yeah, that I got the origin of this wine I was drinking wrong, and that is from Friuli, as is Jonathan. Milan from Tolmezzo, the home, but this, as we know, as long-time listeners of the Cycling Podcast know, this is very much disputed. Tolmezzo claims to be the town that gave birth to tiramisu. Unfortunately for Tolmezzo, Treviso also claims to be the town that gave birth to tiramisu. No stage win today and no attempt to win the stage for Tadej Pogacar. We did wonder, partly because of that sort of cryptic answer he gave in the press conference yesterday about whether he was going to try to win every stage. And if you looked at the bare statistics and the gradient of Capomele and how far it was from the finish, there wasn't that much difference between yesterday's finale and today's finale. There was scope there, as we saw with what Ganna did. There was scope there to try something. He said in his winners' press conference, in his Maglia Rosa press conference, that he was too far back. But that suggested there may have been the intention, or half an intention, half a mind, to try something as well today.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's a gut feeling. I'm kind of convinced that he's saving himself until the gravel stage. I think that's the next time he can put other riders in a spot of trouble, and then obviously the time trial looming in the next weekend.
Yeah, I overheard a conversation with Luke Plapp yesterday between the journalist and
Silvio Martinello, the classiest guys on the bike.
He was a track rider himself. I overheard a conversation yesterday, Brian. Luke Plapp was talking to our colleague from Cycling News, Barry Ryan, about that time trial, and he was talking about how difficult it's going to be. Luke Plapp, I know, has reconned that stage, that course, and he was talking about how difficult the final climb is and how you're going to have to really, really economize and be careful on the flat section before that, and really just concentrate on staying as aerodynamic as possible without going too deep, and which would suggest that as much as we thought that it was going to be perfect for Pogacar, it's even more perfect than we realized.
I mean, it finishes in Perugia, and there's no way of ending in Perugia without climbing, because it's an Umbrian hilltop village.
Town. Brian, lots of talk about shorts today. Tadej Pogacar shorts. That was one of the big topics of conversation yesterday. It's going to be a struggle, I think, for some people during this Giro d'Italia to come up with new topics to talk about with Tadej Pogacar. And, well, the shorts issue, the fact that he wore these Ciclamino kind of plum-coloured shorts yesterday, that caused a lot of teeth gnashing. We wondered why it was.
Polemica.
There was a bit of a polemica. I don't know how officially this was given, this explanation. I didn't read any communique to this effect today, but basically it filtered out that the shorts were supposed to match. There's a trim on the Maglia Rosa this year, which is a kind of tribute to the Grande Torino, which we talked a lot about in the first or on the first weekend of the race. They, of course, played in this maroon color, Granata, and the shorts were supposed to match that. However, I was at the bus this morning, the UAE bus in Acqui Terme, where Pogacar, well, he exited to a rousing reception from local fans and particularly kids. Lots of chants of Poggy, Poggy. And he had black shorts on. We subsequently learned, he explained in his press conference, that the UCI had vetoed the Ciclamino shorts, which was good news as far as I was concerned, because they struck a sort of discordant note for me. The reason that the UCI didn't authorise them today, and in fact, Pogacar, I think, would have been fined if he had worn them today, was that there are two choices when you are leading, I think, any competition in a UCI race. You wear black, or no, you wear your existing team colour bottoms, or you wear shorts that match the prize jersey.
Yeah, but here's the difficult bit. I'll probably say that, especially on a stage like today, probably 90% of the riders are in the skin suit. It's more the standard than it's the opposite. And if he's wearing a pink jersey, it needs to be the one that he's provided, because he's riding with a different clothing sponsor than the clothing sponsor Giro has. So that would mean he would ride, potentially not being able to ride a one piece, and then get the pink jersey from RCS and then wear his own shorts, and thus lose an aerodynamic advantage. Mm. Not that he needs it, I believe, but still, yeah. I think that's something that needs to be ironed out a little bit better. Mm. And as we all know, skin suits need to really fit. Mm. That's the whole point of wearing them.
Mm. Brian, just a couple more things on Pogacar. I asked him in the press conference about the fact that his team, UAE Team Emirates, replaced Jay Vine, who had a crash a few weeks ago and couldn't take part in the Giro d'Italia.
Asked about that at a press conference.
Yeah, I asked about it in the press conference. They replaced him with a Norwegian, and Norwegian ruler, Vegard Stecker Langen. And two very different profiles of riders. Vine is a climber, Langen is very much a ruler. I asked Pogacar what he thought of that, and, well, you would expect him to say that he was happy with the decision. But he did explain. He said that he realised that his team was going to have to do a lot of pulling on the flat in this Giro d'Italia, which suggests to me that maybe he's not thinking about giving away the pink jersey anytime soon. So he was very happy with that. Another thing I wanted to mention was that just on his attack yesterday, there were some, again, sort of crusty old, cranky old timers of Giri of yesteryear, sort of suggesting that he was wasting too much energy. One thing that was said as well, though, was that his legs are so good and he's so strong that he simply can't help himself. The bike is almost kind of jumping out from underneath him when he turns the pedals. And this got me thinking, Brian, about that sensation that, you know, some of us have been lucky enough to experience once or twice in our lives. That sort of no chain feeling, diamonds in the legs. Brian, have you ever experienced that?
Yeah, I have. It's been a while, I have to say. You know, I used to be a runner such as yourself, and I believe that you call it a runner's high. You know, it's kind
yeah,
of
that's
a,
kind of a different thing. To be honest, I think that's a phenomenon that people have different definitions for.
Yeah, I know more about getting high than about running, but on the subject, the last time was, and I actually had to look that up because we'll talk about the stage tomorrow later on, but it's actually on the climb where I got my PR. I don't use Strava anymore, but when I got my PR on that, which is the last climb tomorrow, the Monte Magno, I definitely couldn't feel the chain. And I am, every other day of the year, I'm reminded very much of not just that chain, but a lot of different chains, I suppose, good and bad. But that was on the Monte Magno when I set my PR there. I believe I was pushing some just short of 400 watts for 9 minutes.
It is, it's a remarkable feeling, isn't it? I suppose many of the listeners and many of our listeners do ride bikes. They will have experienced that at some point. And you do sort of seem to get into, you feel as though you're going to this kind of transcend. It's not a sort of gradual journey there. It's just one day, all of a sudden, you might be pretty fit, but then one day, all of a sudden, you do feel as though you're kind of floating on a sort of magic carpet. Brian, one rider in this Giro d'Italia who has felt like that recently, I can reveal, is the rider who almost took the first Maglia Rosa of this Giro d'Italia, an Italian rider by the name of Nicola Conci, Alpecin De Koninck rider. He's never won a race. Nicola Conci is 27 years old. Of course, he had 4 years at Trek. He was at Gazprom when that all kind of went...
Blew up.
Yeah, blew up.
Caught fire.
Yeah, without being too glib about it, when the Russian conflict with Ukraine broke out. And he was picked up by Alpecin De Koninck. Now, he said something after that attempt to win stage one, which nearly came to fruition. He said something to our good friends and colleagues at Gironimo. He talked about how in the lead up to the Giro d'Italia, in the days preceding the Giro d'Italia, his legs were on fire. And he took that form into the first stage. Brian, that and a couple of other things, which we'll hear about in a minute, made me think that Nicola Conci would be a good candidate for our Chiacchierata del Giorno. The conversation took place yesterday. Can you remember where we were yesterday morning? But it was yesterday morning anyway. And here is today's Chiacchierata del Giorno with Nicola Conci.
La Chiacchierata del Giorno. The chin wag of the day.
Ya chica se me ahoría que tonía, que ida tira capiso silo, que sosilo.
Well, Nicola, I wanted to speak to you today because I was listening to the Gironimo podcast, the Italian podcast, the other day, and well, you were talking about your attack on stage one. And this was a result of feeling incredible in the couple of days before the Giro. You even thought your power meter might be broken. Just that feeling for a bike rider, for a professional bike rider, that rare feeling that your legs are just on fire. Just describe that feeling.
Well, I've been working really hard, actually, the last few months already. I started the season with good feelings, but then I got a little bit sick before Strada and Tirreno, and there I have to say I struggled quite a lot. But from there on, I started my build-up towards the Giro, let's say, because I've been on altitude on Sierra Nevada, then straight to Basque Country, where I actually crashed. And then again, I went straight away on Etna this time, on altitude. And when I came down 1 week before the Giro, I started feeling really good. And yeah, as I said, the day before the race, as 2 days before we only did some rollers easily, I needed to do some openers, as we call them. And yeah, legs felt really good. And I thought for one moment maybe something was wrong with the power meter, but then the day after I still felt good. So yeah, I'm in a good shape and I'm really happy about this. But we can do something good for me, for the team, with Caden today, and then we'll have a look at the other stages.
So when you looked at the power meter, how wrong was it? Would you have said, oh, I think I'm doing 500 and it was actually 550? How wrong was it?
Yeah, something like this. Usually you try to go around threshold or maybe just a little bit more, but there I was doing like 2 minutes efforts, and I was easily doing VO2 max or aerobic maximum power, so that was good. And yeah, hopefully legs will be good for the whole Giro.
Nicola, your hero, according to the Alpecin website, your sporting hero is Reinhold Messner, which suggests that, well, you're from Trento, you're from the mountains, so you've grown up with the legend of Messner. But just talk to us about your fascination with him.
Yeah, I have a lot of heroes for the sport, let's say. But I'm really into mountains, and Reinhold Messner, he was the first guy to climb the whole 14,000, and no one in history will be like him, because he was the first to do it. Like, he was the first to climb Nanga Parbat from the Rupal face, and he even came down to the other side, the Amir, which is something still today unbelievable to do, almost. So he will always be the first one in many things of what he's done. So that's why I like him so much.
Do you hike or do you climb when you go into the mountains?
I usually hike. I used to climb a little bit in the past, but yeah, nowadays cycling, it doesn't allow you to take as much rest as we wish. So after 2-3 weeks, you basically are already on the bike again. And yeah, doing a hike is okay, but climbing maybe can be dangerous, so it's better to avoid it. Hopefully I'll do it after my career, and for sure I would like to go and see the 8000ers, at least from below.
Last thing, Nicola, what's your favorite, well, location on a mountain in near Trento? What's your favorite maybe walk to do in the mountains in Trento?
I'm from Pergine Valsugana, and behind that town starts a mountain chain, which in Italy it's called the Tibet of the Alps, because it's one of the most untouched mountain parts of the Alps, and it's the Lago Rai chain of mountain, and there I really like to hike. It's really beautiful. There is only one road made of asphalt that crosses this mountain chain, and it's Passo Mangen.
Yeah, excellent. Grazie mille, grazie Nicola. Ciao ciao. Nicola Conci, look out for him on the Strade Bianche stage 6. Who was it? Someone told me today. Oh, it's Max Chandri, who we'll hear from in a minute, actually, the Movistar Direct Sportif, Tuscan, super Tuscan, I think we called him a few years ago. He thinks a break will go to the finish on stage 6 to Rapolano Terme.
Exactly.
And Nicola Conci could be a candidate. Do you know, that would be very apt, because in Strade Bianche earlier this year, Nicola Conci finished outside the time limit. So that would be a lovely redemption story if he was to win that stage. But don't stake the family chateau on it, I would suggest. Well,
diamonds are found in the dirt, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Brian, today for us was an intriguing journey for reasons I talked about earlier on, this kind of transition into a different climate, almost a different Italy, really, when you cross those Apennines, the kind of end of the Apennines, the northern end of the Apennines, and you arrive on the Riviera down here. But we went on another journey, an odyssey, which we sort of like to undertake, particularly at the Giro d'Italia on the cycling podcast. We like to sort of don our deerstalkers and do a bit of detective work, and particularly if it involves sort of exploring myths, legends, folklore of the Giro d'Italia. And that's precisely what we did today, particularly when we saw that Savona was on the route of today's stage. Now, Savona, it means one thing, really, in Giro d'Italia history. It's something that occurred there in 1969. The protagonist, he hadn't been the protagonist, was a certain Eddie Merckx.
Comune di Albisola Superiore. Se si conosce l'interno desiderato, digitarlo ora.
No, c'è canonico, non do. La faina prede.
Pronto, mi sente? Buongiorno, una domanda un po' particolare. Io sono un giornalista che sto seguendo il Giro d'Italia. Sì?
86.
So Brian, no luck with Albisola Superiore. Try Albisola Marina now. But that caused a lot of confusion. That call, didn't
it? Sense.
Yeah, although some of the reports I found referred to Albisola Superiore. But
biciclismo, praticamente stiamo seguendo il Giro d'Italia. Negli anni 60 è successo un fatto. Grazie mille. Grazie a Reci.
I looked at all the hotels in Albisola and the current existing ones, and they didn't really find any that looked like that.
Can you send me the photo?
Oh, Brian, I think we're getting warm. We're not getting hot yet, but we're getting warm. Gentlemen there.
Qua siamo a... sì, ho capito.
Ho due foto.
Capito, siamo a Vigo qua, vi sono a Vigo. Sì, allora.
Brian, remember I saw it said there was a curved roof at the end of the road? Just one second. I don't know whether... You see these... There are these citrus trees here. Or agrumi. I think this is the road. I'm just going to walk down here, Brian, to the end of this. Yeah. Scusi, signora. Lei vive qua da tanto tempo? C'era una volta qua un hotel Excelsior?
Sì,
sì, però tanti anni fa, però dov'era di preciso?
Era lì, da quel terrazzo lì.
Questo palazzo? Sì?
Sì, da dove c'è il terrazzo lì.
Va bene. Brian, so I found a lady who has lived here for a long time and she said yeah, there used to be the Excelsior here. And she said, yeah, back in Merckx's day. And I said, ah, yeah, that's why I'm here. Oh, wow. That's why I'm here. So if you want to lock up the car and come down, unfortunately, it's not a hotel anymore, so I don't think we'll be able to go inside, but...
All right, well, you found it. I'll be there in a minute.
Yep. Brian, you have to... So this is it.
This one?
Yeah, well, yeah, just let's help me with this. We'll have to reconstruct this. I'm pretty sure it's that building. So, okay. So this is the hotel.
Yeah.
We're looking... You remember that I recognised the shape of the roof?
Yeah, that's the one.
So, the hotel is that building or this one? That one.
Yeah, that one, because you see the double... terraces there. Yeah,
this was the terrace. I'm quite proud of us, Brian, for doing... Yeah. That was quite difficult.
And you see those two bits there on the roof? One, two.
Yeah. And now it's a vet.
Yeah. And but these lemon trees, you see those orange trees?
Yeah.
They're standing the same way as they always did. They just removed a couple of them.
So, Brian, we should give some context. We're here because one of the more famous events in the history of the Giro d'Italia occurred here. It's always referred to as the events of Savona. We're not in Savona, we're in Albisola. Can you remember? Are we in Marina or Superiore? We're kind of between the two now, aren't we?
Yeah, we're actually in Marina because the Superiore is just up the road.
Okay, so I knew that this occurred. Obviously, I wrote a book about Eddie Merckx, and I knew this occurred. Well, he was informed when he was in the Hotel Excelsior with his teammates the following morning after the stage from Parma to Savona. And this gave rise to one of the most famous images ever in Giro d'Italia history, and it's Merckx sort of curled up in a fetal position on his bed, and he's been interviewed by Sergio Zavoli, who was the historic kind of host of the Processo alla Tappa, the big show, sort of post-race show in the Giro d'Italia, and he's sobbing. In fact, Brian, I think we can hear that now.
Quello però io sempre mi vuole stare un sportivo regolare e mi batte.
So Brian, that was Eddie Merckx effectively being kicked out of the Giro d'Italia. He was going to win pretty certain that he was going to win for the second year in a row. It was going to be his second Grand Tour victory, and well, a huge scandal. I think probably I said to you earlier, probably the most iconic photograph or image ever of a cyclist in a hotel room was that one up there, room 11, first floor. We're probably not going to get.
I mean, this could be his balcony, couldn't it?
Yeah, and we found it thanks to a local lady who lives opposite. I saw her up there, called up, asked whether she remembered the Hotel Excelsior, and she said, oh yeah, I remember it, but it's been gone for a long time now. It used to exist back in Merckx's day. I don't know whether she saw my Giro d'Italia pass and knew what I was looking for. But I've had to refresh my memory about exactly what occurred, all of the events. If you'll just indulge me for a minute, I'll read the first couple of paragraphs in the book I wrote about Eddie Merckx, and I dedicated a couple of chapters to what happened. Of all the flowers that were gladioli in reception, the symbols of moral integrity, someone from the Faema team had handed them to the receptionist in the Hotel Excelsior the previous evening, and now there they were, poking pathetically out of a crystal vase like leftover burnt-out candles. On the first floor, in room 11, big Martin van den Bossa looked at his empty bed, then to the one at its left, where Merckx lay, sobbing uncontrollably. Fed up with the constant knocks at the door and interruptions to their morning routine, he had joked just a few minutes earlier to Merckx that the next person who disturbed them was going to get it. When the Faema manager, Vincenzo Giacotto, pushed the door, van den Bossa had thrown a pillow that struck Giacotto in the face. The giggles had quickly subsided when Giacotto's stony expression didn't change. What could van den Bossa say now? There was nothing, so he said almost nothing. In any case, many more gifted linguists had now arrived in the room, like La Gazzetta's Bruno Araschi, who had come with Giacotto. In a few hours, Araschi would pen one of his more unusual reports from a Giro stage. I can believe that they've found Merckx drugged, but I'm sure that someone put the dope in his broth, will be his instinctive conclusion. So, and thereafter, Sergio Zavoli conducted that very famous interview. Brian, I was talking to you in the car about some of the more sort of, some lurid sort of conspiracy theories about what had actually happened. One of the most sort of intriguing one was that the previous morning, well, Merckx had gone to Mass in Parma. The stage started just outside the Duomo in Parma, and Merckx had popped inside and he'd gone to Mass. And he'd left his bike outside, and subsequently there were eyewitness reports, supposedly, of someone changing the bead on his bike. Back in the day, positive dope tests were pretty commonplace, and Merckx's punishment was a suspension of a couple of weeks. And sure enough, then he came back at the Tour de France a few weeks later, and he crushed everyone. Probably his most emphatic and famous Tour de France victory, his first Tour de France victory.
There's a vet here now.
I know.
But it's cunning, isn't it? Because it's actually completely because of that. It's a little bit strange roof.
The curving roof.
And then these orange trees that we can see in that old postcard type of photo.
Yeah.
But it's been painted over, hasn't it? And all the colors of the terraces are different. But it's also that it makes me think, how you always talk about. If a rider's been tested positive, it had a sanction, there's an asterisk from, that era or that specific race. And it's just that it seems like those asterisks have gone bigger, or they were more diminished back then.
Yeah, I've talked about this a lot, the fact that the punishments at the time almost kind of reflected the dimensions of the kind of peccadillo, the sin in people's
cultural severity.
Yeah, in people's eyes. And it was only really with the Festina scandal where we went from sort of 6 months of suspensions to quickly they became 2-year suspensions that people started to think about doping differently as something very sinister. And then we had blood doping, and people used to think of it in terms of syringes and shady doctors, sort of Dracula-like figures. Back then, as I say, it was a kind of minor peccadillo. That was how it was regarded. And indeed, as we know, Merckx tested positive 3 times in his career. Brian, I'm glad we did it.
I was about to say the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Once again, you were lucky. You found the right person at the right time.
Yeah, lucky. And luck and skill, Brian. You make your own luck in this game. As Gary Player used to say, the more I practice, the luckier I get. And we've done a few of these now.
Maybe you should set up a company as like a private investigator.
Yeah, there should be a plaque though, shouldn't there?
Well,
there really should.
We should make one.
Well, Brian, that was a wild ride, wasn't it, today? A lot of phone calls. That odyssey started this morning at breakfast. You'd had your breakfast before me today. And I started looking at images. The first step was to establish whether this Hotel Excelsior still existed. It seemed to no longer exist. I then, continued to Google, and I found two pictures of this hotel in the 70s. One was like a postcard from 1975 that is for sale on eBay, and another one, it was another postcard from the 70s. So two different angles of this hotel, which I believed, and we had confirmed to us later, no longer existed. I then went on to Google Earth and started looking at the shape of roofs in Albisola, Albisola Marina, Albisola Superiore. Then a series of phone calls to the councils in both places. And then the tourist office. Then we spoke to a gentleman working for the council sweeping the roads. And it finally, we just kept getting closer and closer and closer. And then finally, a lady on a balcony, she sort of turned the key and unlocked this mystery. And it was quite fun, wasn't it?
Yeah. It actually reminds me of the opening lines of a book that's come into memory as of recent, the New York Trilogy, which is obviously three books, and it was written by an author that died last week, Paul Auster. And the opening line, I believe, in the first book in the New York Trilogy is, "It all started with a phone call." And there we were, and it felt a bit like a sort of you being a private detective and me being your driver and your fellow Dr. Watson type of person.
You almost got the hat for it, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, Brian, I think we pretty much explained what happened to Mertz in 1969 in that little sort of audio montage you heard. The drug that he tested positive for was fencamphamine. It was a drug that was quite commonly used by cyclists at that time. As we said, he got a very short suspension, and it was, I mean, it's still, there's no doubt about it, it's still a very sore subject for Eddie Merckx. And it was, as I said there, it was one of three occasions when he tested positive in the Giro d'Italia. In fact, when we came to the press room, Brian, I saw our good friend Renard, who works for Sportzo, who of course is the broadcaster in Belgium, and I told him about this voyage that we'd been on, this kind of investigation that we'd done. And of course he found it quite amusing, and he was very keen to hear about it, but he said, well, I wouldn't dare to do the same thing in Belgium.
Or to do stand up on Belgian TV tonight.
Yeah, because it probably wouldn't go down very well.
No.
The
sleeping dogs lie, I suppose. But the interesting thing is that, you know, I think I spoke about that as well in what the listeners heard, this asterisk that's between certain names in cycling, and for other generations later on, for the better, I would say, it's not just an asterisk, it's an obelisk stone, you know, in the shoe and or even in the eye of the person in question.
And Brian, we're sitting at a bar just near the press room here, and there are these sort of pamphlets in the bar that have been, I guess, distributed to local businesses. And it's a sort of compendium of Liguria. Liguria is the region we're in. Liguria's relationship with the Giro d'Italia. And of course, the sort of the centerfold, the most important story, the story to which they dedicate the most space, is Merckx and Savoy on the 2nd of June 1969, the day that rocked cycling, is the headline. And we've got quite a detailed piece there about exactly what happened. Brian, it's about time we talk not about the past, but, well, we'll talk about the recent past, we'll talk about last night's dinner, but also about the future, tomorrow's stage.
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, yesterday's dinner, where you got slightly riled because I wasn't drinking enough wine last night. You thought that I was, disrespecting the beautiful kind of context in which we found ourselves.
And the choice of wine as well.
Yeah, I mean, we had a lovely wine. We had a Barbaresco from the Produttori Barbaresco, which
from
is...
from the renowned vineyard of Assili.
Yeah.
My favourite.
Which was excellent, but I caught it a night there because I had it... was very at the forefront of my mind. I was going to go for a nice longish run this morning, which I did. So I, you know, one glass, one and a half glasses, and that was it.
Well, I enjoyed a second glass of a bottle that our host at the restaurant kindly opened and served at a ridiculously low price. It was from Canova, which is a second favorite Barbaresco producer of mine, the Montefico. Also one of the Grand Cru vineyards of Barbaresco, which was just across the river, the Tanaro River, from where we were staying. And what a lovely little town you found for us, the Guarene. Never been on my radar. It's in the Roero district, so a little bit in the outskirts of the, say, the Lange galaxy of wine. It's a neighboring wine region, still using the same types of grapes, being a Nebbiolo.
And we could see Barbaresco if we looked straight across the valley over the Tanaro. river, we could see Barbaresco. Food-wise, Brian, I had some gnocchetti, little gnocchi, with the other thing, as well as wine, that area is very, very famous for growing, is hazelnuts. And it was a kind of hazelnut gnocchetti, and they were very good. Different region. One thing we've said about Piedmontese cuisine, Piedmont is renowned as probably the, alongside Emilia-Romagna and the sort of Bologna area, the area in Italy with the finest dining, I suppose.
Well, it's also its connection to France and how, you know, being part of the Savoyan kingdom, and it's a bit more refined, it's a bit more noble maybe, and I would say it's such a wonderful place to visit even if you aren't interested in wines. I mean, the food, you know, is obviously also famous for white truffles, etc. So it's just
the mushrooms,
it's just a delight really to visit for anyone.
But one thing we did say, Brian, is that we ate in four really good restaurants over four nights, and the menus tend to be quite similar. You see the same dishes.
I think I had the same food three nights in a row
in every restaurant, and now we have moved into a completely different region and we'll get completely different food.
Seafood.
Seafood. We're in the land of pesto, and trofia is the pasta that's traditionally eaten with pesto. So that's what I'll be on the lookout for this evening, Brian. Tomorrow's stage, we head into, well, your adopted home region. We will no longer, by the time we reach the finish tomorrow, we'll no longer be in Liguria. We'll be in Tuscany. Who else is from Tuscany? Well, another familiar voice on Cycling Podcast. It's the former classics hunter turned Direct Sportif, he's now with Movistar, Maximilian Max Chandri. And Brian, you're off duty this evening because Max is going to present tomorrow's stage for us and for you.
So stage five, we have Genova Lucca, so obviously close to my house. Genova, I know we do one climb, the only big climb of the day is Passo del Bracco. We do it every now and then, we've done it before. It's between Liguria and Tuscany, the two regions. It's a long climb, gradually. I don't have the percentage right now, but I think 4 or 5%, a pretty long climb. We drop down and then we start to approach Massa, kind of go through the area where Tirreno starts, and then into Lucca, where we do Monte Magno. That's a stage, it's the first climb of the first stage of Tirreno, usually. But then we drop down and then it's a gradual rolling down. Actually, I did a training camp there with MG on the road. And we go into Lucca, and outside the walls of Lucca, that's the finish line. We go through a little bit of a section of Pavé, a couple roundabouts into the finish line.
And just tell us a little bit about the history, the heritage of Lucca as a cycling, as a, well, a place where cyclists have lived and grown up.
Yeah, I mean, Cipo's house is in Lucca, Uli house from SRM is in Lucca, and Bianeris used to live in Lucca. In the days, there's a lot of Danish and tons of riders in the area. I mean, in my days, there's, we had from Taffy, Sorensen, Bartoli, myself. I mean, Casagrande, there's a lot of riders. So it's and I was actually just watching the other day, and the last time a Giro went into Lucca, we're talking about the 70s, I think. Yeah, I think, I don't want to say, you know, won a stage, but something like that. And we had the World Championships start in Lucca when we had the World Championships in Florence. I think maybe the TT or the road race. I can't remember what started in Lucca.
So, sprint, Max, stage five to Lucca?
Yeah, sprint day.
Brian, did Max do a good job there, do you think? Shall we invite him back tomorrow for the second Tuscan stage?
I think so. I mean, I feel snubbed because it's also, you know, it's my home. It's actually the race of, if I can just add to that, very precise and lovely description by Max. The race passes my town tomorrow in Pietrasanta, and it's actually my daughters, I have two twin daughters, as you know, their kindergarten shuts early because of it, and it's literally like riding right next to them, to where they are every day, and then it actually goes across Camaiore and then into Lucca, which is the first town I ever lived in when I moved to Tuscany, and that stretch of road from Pietrasanta up the Monte Magno, the last climb, Caterers climb, small climb, it's not really a climb in that sense, and then down to Valfredana. I've spent my entire Tuscan life on those last probably be like 40 kilometers.
And you hold the record on Strava, and Pogacar will get nowhere near it. Isn't that what you told me earlier?
Well, I actually checked. I don't really use Strava anymore. I've done that climb officially 87 times from that side.
But the local legend is Raimondas Rumsas.
Yeah, because he's done it 19 times in the last, I believe, 90 days or so. But the fastest time, and I'm not following him on Strava, not surprisingly, that is Mario Cipollini.
Oh, don't mention Cipollini. Rumsas,
yes, he had a fight on that climb. Yeah,
with
Rumsas. Yeah, they actually, that was...
People who are not familiar with the professional cycling pre-2010 have turned off at this point. They had no idea who we're talking about. Rumsas and Cipollini, now training partners, or were training partners, riding partners until recently, where they had a bust up, and this was captured on camera.
On the Montemagno.
Yeah, and this was sort of circulated around, well...
Your WhatsApp and mine.
Yeah, my WhatsApp, your WhatsApp, and people who are loosely connected with Italian cycling. Brian, I think that's about it for this evening. Just a final footnote. Today, the 7th of May, would have been the birthday of our late great leader, co-founder, friend, Richard Moore, who, as regular listeners will know, well, he loved the Giro d'Italia. He loved doing exactly the kind of thing we did today when we went to Savona on the trail of Eddie Merckx and 1969. We did a lot of that, Rich and I, in 2021, his last Giro d'Italia. And I thought it would be appropriate to play out today with Richard. Last voice you're going to hear tonight is Richard's, and he is reading a passage from 1949 account of the Giro d'Italia, written by a very famous Italian writer called Dino Buzzati. We've played this before on the podcast, but it's Buzzati talking about the beauty of the Giro. Brian, you've just written the foreword for a Danish translation of exactly the same Buzzati compendium of writings about the Giro d'Italia. So now to Richard reading Dino Buzzati.
In the middle of the immense tide of cars that ebbed slowly from the Monza Autodrome the day before yesterday, backlit by the setting sun's fading rays, it looked like a herd wreathed in dust that one sees in westerns. Here and there, lost in this gigantic chaos, some spots of vivid colour stood out. It was the racers, still wearing their jerseys and transfigured by the exertion. Some were perched on the team cars among the spare wheels, others leaned out of a truck's rear window, and others were still on their bicycle saddles because no one in this throng had bothered to give them a lift. And so they had 15 kilometres of extra effort to complete the Giro, adding to 4,000 kilometres already done. They saw us, they saw our dusty car, our official nameplate, our sunbaked faces. We belonged to the same gang, them and us, fragments of a small, fascinating world that was at last dispersing to re-enter the dullness of everyday life. We looked at each other with a sad, understanding smile, like soldiers returning from war who, in the hubbub of a big railway station, are immediately considered as brothers. During the Giro, we and the racers had remained virtual strangers. But now, no. Now all the others were strangers, and we instead were suddenly friends. We alone in that crowd could understand each other, parties to a secret full of melancholy. For 19 days, we had seen them gallop throughout the entire peninsula with great astonishment. Their legs the sole source of energy. And we then watched them continue in the Alps on the climbs and descents right next to precipices. 1/100th of what the last of them had done would have crushed us even 20 years ago when we were young, and we would have been taken to the hospital for at least a month. What remained now of all this frightful labour? Had it produced anything? Nothing. Pure fatigue, then, offered in sacrifice to a senseless mania. And yet, as soon as these men proceeded, passing from city to city, the people, astonishingly, abandoned their business or their spade, jumped out of bed, came down from the remotest homesteads, travelled very long distances on foot, waited in the rain and the sun for entire mornings, and there they were, the people of all Italy, farmers, labourers, old salts, mothers, decadent old men, paralytics, priests, beggars, thieves, massed along 4,000 kilometres. And they weren't what they were the day before. A new, powerful feeling possessed them. They were laughing, yelling, the sorrows of life forgotten for a few instants. They were happy, without a doubt. And we can vouch for that here.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.